8.06 FM Talk 106.5. We'll be on mornings on a Wednesday. Y'all say hello to Jeff Poor. Of course, you read his work in Lanyap, Yellowhammer News, Breitbart, and host of the Jeff Poor Show on WVNN. A man who did a great job for me on Monday, too, for Midday Mobile. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Sean. Thanks for the kind words.
It was good. Good deal. So I want to talk about that as well, because we have to get you to do that more, because I'm going to have to go. It looks like if the discussion out there for the second wave of coronavirus is right, then I'll need to go shelter at the house and probably not even get near a microphone for a couple months. So you ready for that?
You got to learn how to do the home broadcast thing.
Yeah. I mean, I could take the equipment there, but I don't think I would have a lot of distractions there. And we'll work on it. I'm going to work on it.
So, built okay. You a padded room, man. It's just like you're back at the mental ward.
Except, it says I don't have that already. Yeah, at the house, the padded room. All right. A lot to get into on the state side and national, but the state side first. So what is the difference? So curbside voting, right? So we were talking about this last hour, and the decision yesterday that by U.S. District Judge Abdul Callan, who put this injunction in. Alabama wanted to limit curbside voting, and this lets it happen? Or can you explain this to me?
Well, the ruling says that they could do it. You know, and we haven't heard from John Merrill yet.
That's what I was wondering, yeah.
Now, I think he's supposed to be on my colleague Del Jackson's show today. We're a month out. You can't just willy-nilly do this without some kind of blueprint or plan. My question is, with this late ruling, how are they going to pull it off? But if I read the ruling correctly, it was just three counties.
Uh-huh.
It was Jefferson, Lee County, and
Mobile.
So then it becomes more of an interesting wrinkle as well. So then I don't know. But it takes time to do these things, right? You can't just say, well, tomorrow is election day. You got to do curbside voting. You got to have a way to, prove an identity through a check. And then once you got that ID, then you when you go vote, you maybe put up a tent. I suppose it could be done, but think how many tents and how many voting precincts there are in all three of those counties.
And how do you staff that efficiently? And, Dalton was commenting last hour to kind of the stock picture that went with one of the stories we were looking at. But, I mean, I'm ignorant to how it works. I mean, do you get in a line like a drive-through and drive up, and then they find your name on the ID, and then do they hand you the Scantron sheet and a clipboard to be able to fill in your things? And, they have a long extension cord to have that machine out there to count? I mean, I don't know, but that's a lot. I mean, they realize that it's just next month. It's just like 3 weeks away before voting day.
And each polling place is different. I wonder, for my polling place, we've got a big curbside area there, so it wouldn't be a problem there. But I wonder some of these other places, is it even possible to have areas right next to the building where you can do this kind of voting?
Right. I think of the COVID-19 testing or something like that. It's not gonna, but I think the way some people envision it is, it'll be like McDonald's where you drive up to a speaker, maybe. I don't know. But
I'd like one from the Republican. Can I make that go large with that?
Super size.
Yeah.
I don't know if it sticks. So, I guess they could appeal it or what they could do, but this presents some hurdles. It is a judge, and this judge is an Obama appointee. And it's a win for the ACLU and this other Poverty Law Center. But I don't know if it's really applicable. How they're going to pull it off, it's just going to create chaos at the precinct.
Yeah, I mean, we have, we kind of have trouble figuring out voting as it is.
I think that July 14th runoff is going to have very low turnout. It's better to do it now than
true.
In a general election. Then it gets really problematic. But on July 14th to do it, then maybe it's more feasible with a lower turnout. But I still think maybe they could do this. Maybe they could say, kind of like they do in Florida with early voting, you don't open every precinct in the county. You open five, right, or six or whatever,
okay.
And you could go early vote. What if you had five or six voting precincts that could offer the drive-in, drive-through ballot procedure?
All right. I want to talk about also one of the stories that we were talking about last hour, the vote by the Montgomery City Council to not make it a mask ordinance, but a pretty narrow margin on that.
Tied vote 4-4. One of the council members in Montgomery was out. That's why it didn't get through.
But oh, really? You think the other vote would have been a yes?
Yeah, I think he's one of the more left-leaning Democrat members of the council. For sure. Yeah, and then I think it would have gone the other way. So that's really what stopped it. I don't know what the future has in store for it, but that's a lot of... it's funny, though. You watch it and you see how it's really divided along ideological lines.
Yeah, and that's... even racial lines in the state with the vote going down to mask or not. And, you know, I guess they let the ordinance expire in Birmingham. I don't know if they brought it back. But am I missing something? Like, we're talking about the spike in surge in cases of COVID-19 out there, but then they go right back to a mask discussion. I'm confused because, like, 2 weeks ago, WHO came out and said the masks aren't necessary if you're not sick. And then the next week they came out and said if you're asymptomatic, your chance of passing along coronavirus is very small. Am I missing something there on the mask? I'm not saying that masks in certain cases they've shown might do something good, but you're putting in an ordinance, even though if you're defaulting to WHO or something like that, that they're coming out and saying, well, maybe you don't need that.
It seems it's an ideological signaling. I don't know. There is a spike in Montgomery. There's no question about it. Will the mask help or not? And you have a few doctors. So they had a city council meeting last night. They had doctors there that were on both sides of this. It is frustrating because you don't really get into it. But we don't know enough about this. And requiring people to do something I think it breaks down this way. Requiring to make it, the government telling people they got to do something is an easy lift for some people and a very, very difficult lift for other people in their minds. And I think that's really where it breaks down on the partisanship.
Jeff, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we were talking about the opening of the beaches. Anderson Cooper sent a reporter down to Baldwin County. They were at the hangout and on the beaches and saying that, you know, it was a disaster waiting to happen. Even the mayor of Montgomery said he was worried about the people of Montgomery going down to the beaches and then coming back. We've been reporting the numbers daily here, and Baldwin County has not seen a spike in cases, and they haven't had a death reported since May 22nd. Is that the topic of any news stories up in North Alabama right now, or by anything you could tell, any other part of Alabama? Because it's pretty amazing that this county that has the beaches in Alabama, they haven't reported a death in nearly a month now.
It is amazing, but I guess they would tell you that the people at the beach weren't maybe necessarily from or of Baldwin County. That they took the virus elsewhere, and it was just risky behavior that they were practicing. That would be my guess.
But they go to stores and restaurants, right, and bars and, you know, trinket shops or whatever. I mean, right?
And it was the same. You remember the big picture that the media loved before we got into Riot Mania, the Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, even at the mayor of St. Louis, well, people are going to come back from the Lake of the Ozarks to bring coronavirus back to my city. And then, you know, it's like 500 miles away or something. Anyway, so that was going on. It is funny, but guess what? MSNBC was doing the same thing. They were back down at Orange Beach shooting footage of people out on the beach. Did they really have this obsession with Gulf Shores, with Baldwin County? And in downtown Mobile, I think they were shooting, I was watching one segment where they were out in front of the old the Loda beer garden or whatever it is right there. It's, you know, just showing people out on the street and not social distancing or wearing masks. So what is it? I'm sure Mobile and Baldwin counties cannot be the only places in America that are shrugging, or there are people where they're shrugging off the threat.
Well, it's just... I really do, whether they do it forensically or they do it in real time, there's something in Baldwin County. And I think it's, we're not even comparing Baldwin County to Montgomery County. Let's just go from one side of the bay to the other. What can be learned, you know? And you got a bigger tourist influx. Yeah, you have a smaller population, but I'm looking per capita on cases. I'm not looking at it per capita. Baldwin County is just way better off.
Well, I just, maybe it has to do with the way people live. They're not bunched up together as they are in a lot of places. That they're more spread out. I think that has something to do with it. Now, here I am playing a medical scientist or whatever, but look at, you know, the density of the populations has something to do with that. It tends to be more prevalent in big cities where you have a bunch of people living together. If you have them more spread out and you know, it is one thing to go out and not interact with people, but if you're like, you know, about 100 people crammed in an apartment building together somewhere in a big city, then, yeah, it seems, you know, that there's going to be more back and forth there.
All right. Coming back from the break, more with Jeff, I want to talk about this push for there to be a Washington state. Wait a second. You're saying there is a Washington. A Washington, D.C. state. 51 states? The District of Columbia becoming a state? Talk about with Jeff when we come back. ...822 FM Talk 106.5 Bobio Morning. Sean Dalton, Jeff Poor. Continue this conversation. Jeff, I saw bits and pieces. You tweeted about it, I think, yesterday, and I saw an AP story this morning about Democrats pushing a vote to make the District of Columbia a state. Is this real? Is this a story from the Babylon Bee? What is this?
Well, they've been trying this for years. There's a constitutional problem here.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Nancy Pelosi messaging bill. It's not going to go anywhere. The Republicans are not going to allow for two more Democrat senators and another Democrat congressman. There was some talk in the past about giving Utah another vote in Congress there were all these deals over time, but it's always ran into the constitutional hurdle. So, but what I think they might try, and I don't think it's going to happen, but still they could try keeping the District of Columbia just the government buildings around the National Mall and, you know, the White House, Capitol Hill, and all the other places in Washington, D.C. in the District of Columbia, make it its own state. Could they do that? Then maybe you give up Arlington and Alexandria and Virginia back to D.C., quote-unquote, and then Virginia goes back red. But I don't think there's any appetite for that. You have all these difficulties with doing it. But Nancy Pelosi, I mean, this is what we're seeing out of Nancy Pelosi's House of Representatives right now. A lot of these type of bills, and they're kind of the wish list of Democrats right now, if you will, because they know that it's not going anywhere in the Senate under Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, you know, you went through kind of the chess game, the chessboard of votes for Republicans and Democrats, but I mean they had a reason after they moved the Capitol a couple times to put it somewhere where it wasn't in a state, right? That one state doesn't have the Capitol, and even though they're saying this, that they would still hold, I guess, that very small district as it is. I mean, is there a hue and cry outside? You know, I guess people that live in those areas of the district. For this
yeah,
to happen?
I mean, what do you ride around Washington, D.C. and their license plate say taxation without representation?
They can move right in. They can move right into Maryland or Virginia if they want to.
Well, yeah, but the city doesn't get to vote. This has been an ongoing fight for the last probably 50 years or so. It's been a big deal to folks in Washington, D.C. But it's the city leaders there. They do have a delegate, what they call it, Eleanor Holmes Norton. They give her committee. She's on a bunch of committees. She has a vote on committees. She just doesn't have a vote on the floor. So there are ways to give D.C. and these other like Puerto Rico and places like that, the Virgin Islands, some kind of elected representation. They just don't have a vote on the floor of the respective chambers.
All right. I want to talk about the story that's been bounced around this week, whether the president is coming to Mobile, which would make it a third time for a rally for Tuberville. That story was out. You had tweeted about it over the weekend. And then this week, we have Ann Davis out at the at Led People saying they hadn't heard of it. City of Mobile said they hadn't been contacted by the White House. And the rally was supposed to be for Tommy Tuberville. And Debbie Williams from KRG caught up with him yesterday down at the beach. And he said he didn't know about it either. Is this still happening? What's the story here?
I still think it's going to happen. Trump wants to do it. And we have an idea why Mobile, why he wants to go to Mobile. Obviously, I think it still happens. It's all coming from the White House. That seems to be where you could trace back all the reports. I think it's coming out of the White House mostly. Some rumblings around Mobile, but I think it probably will happen.
Okay.
July 11th was the date they threw out. Whether or not that is in stone or not, I don't think so. I think it could change. That's the date they would like to do it in the White House, probably. I think it will happen. They may have to make some kind of accommodations for the city or for the state, and maybe they're just waiting to see. But I definitely think the White House wants it to make it happen. And it's not like anybody. And then the Tuberville campaign extension of that, those guys, I think, wouldn't mind if it happened.
I'm sure they'd be thrilled.
And it's my understanding that the Tuberville campaign didn't think that they needed that help. They didn't think they needed a Trump visit, at least at this moment in time.
Why wouldn't they take that?
So that later on, if you are in the general election, maybe you could play that card if needed against Doug Jones. But I would think that the meeting Jeff Sessions would be much more difficult than Doug Jones in the general.
Yeah, me too.
But that is I think the calculation there is, yeah, we'll take it. We'll absolutely take it. But we don't think that we quote unquote need it. When I say need it, that we need it to beat Jeff Sessions.
Yeah, but it's almost letting the president's doing this probably as much for himself versus Jeff Sessions as he is for Tommy Tuberville.
Well, that's a discussion that you are in the Pensacola media market as well, and you pick up. You could do a lot of things with data, and you get that hit in the very very western part of the Florida Panhandle. Perhaps you get a bump off of that in a big important swing state. So there are other motivations here, but for the president, I don't think he's thinking. He wants to really stick it to his former attorney general.
Hey, what about the event for Tulsa? What's your take on that for the president?
I'm surprised they're doing it indoors. I don't know why Tulsa, why Oklahoma. There's a lot of questions there, but they're doing it, and there's almost a situation here where we had all these protests. And the White House wanted to make a statement, and they're not going to be deterred, and that's the direction it seems to be to me.
All right, and I guess I got to ask this question: Is Governor Ivey still in the state? Is she doing? I have heard nothing from the governor's office.
I said this yesterday. Sean Ross, Yellhammer News, and I were talking about this. She hasn't done anything since the COVID stuff. She's put out two press releases. No media availability, has been nowhere, not to be seen. And I'll say this, and I hate to use this storyline, but a lot of us were out there defending her and her health when these allies of Walt Maddox were running up and making that claim back in 2018. To disappear at a time when all these other governors in the adjoining states are out and about it on TV every day, it's very curious. And I think if there's ever been a crisis situation, it's that you needed that leadership at the very top to be out and about and seen. It's right now.
Yeah, and it's just the contrary to that. So I'm glad I'm not the only one thinking about that. Jeff, as always, we appreciate your time. People want to follow you online. Where do they go?
It's twitter.com/Jeff_Poor.
All right. There he is, Jeff Poor, joining us. And we'll get your calls when we get back at 343-0106, 343-0106. Also, a couple other the debate over Aunt Jemima. Aunt Jemima, which I thought would have come way before a lot of these other discussions. And then now Mrs. Buttersworth in the discussion.
And Uncle Ben's.
Yeah. Well, how about Hungry Man? Is he okay? All right. We'll come back with that after news. Okay, 8:37, coming to the phones. Just give me 1 minute. I want to give you an update on what I mentioned before the break. So these are the stories that will drive the narrative because it's pedestrian enough. It's known to all of us, these products out here from DenverNewsChannel.com. One of the many stories out today about the Aunt Jemima pancake mix and syrup. It says Quaker Oats, parent company of Aunt Jemima Pancake Mix and Syrup, says it'll completely rebrand the line, including changing the name and logo, saying the current brand is based on a, quote, racial stereotype, end quote. Okay? We recognize Aunt Jemima's origins are based in a racial stereotype, said Kristen Cruffle, the vice president, chief marketing officer at Quaker Foods North America. I wonder what the Quakers think about that. This says, as we work to make progress towards racial equality through several initiatives, we must also take a hard look at our portfolio of brands and ensure they reflect our values and meet our consumers' expectations, end quote. According to Adweek, bottles of syrup and boxes of pancake mix will no longer carry the image of Aunt Jemima beginning in the fourth quarter of this year. The name change will be announced at a later date. Aunt Jemima debuted in 1889 as the world's first ready-made pancake mix, and for decades, mascot drew on the Mammy stereotype, a minstrel caricature of black women that reinforces slavery-era values like loyal servitude. The caricature is often represented as a heavy-set black woman with a handkerchief in her hair. All right, so it goes on, blah, 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 stuff you know. All right. What gets me on this is it's, with all the other things that have been toppled, renamed, done away with, that are on public spaces and should have the vote of the people, I would argue, in that city or that county or here in Alabama, the state level, this is a private brand. Private brand's job is to make money.
Right.
You know, like they'll say, oh, that evil corporation. I say, corporations aren't evil. Corporations are doing what they're supposed to do. Corporations there to make money. It has no reason to exist other than making money. That is why it is there, even though that's changed now.
Yeah.
Right? It has to. So if I'm Quaker Foods, which I think what they're going to go after that next, because Quaker, a Protestant group, and it's signaling Christianity, so they ought to change the name of Quaker Foods as well, just saying. But I'd have changed the name of this product way back. I mean, for them to say, oh, now's the time they're going to take this on. As much as I'm less scratching my head on the number of things that are being removed around the country, this one, to me, is low-hanging fruit. But then they started talking about Mrs. Buttersworth.
Right.
Okay? And they got a big discussion of what her race was. I tell you, maybe I just didn't have enough time on my hands. I never worried about that growing up, but I guess they're saying, well, she's white. So Mrs. Buttersworth is fine because she's white. They're going to keep that. But what about like Hungry Jack? I've never seen Hungry Jack. There's Hungry Jack pancakes. I've never seen the Jack of Hungry Jack before.
Yeah, what's his race? I'm with you.
I don't care. Just make the stinking pancake and put some syrup on it.
Aunt Jemima is, it's been used as a racial slur for years and years and years, and it is, I think, stereotype.
That's what I'm saying. So why is that product still sitting here? Now we're having this discussion when other things have been brought down in the past that have at least an argument of historical significance, have been around.
Mm-hmm. We're having the discussion now, I think, because social media and online protests, and we saw a lot of it, I think, starting, last week, and then last night, if you were on Twitter at all, there were a lot more people talking about it, but saying they might boycott Quaker Foods or PepsiCo, and that's where the...
Fine. That's a private company. They're going to make a decision based on that. My question is why is it now? Why wouldn't that... I mean, with all the other things that have now been renamed or moved, and we're now getting around to Aunt Jemima?
Yeah, and I think part of it is...
Aunt Jemima should have been way back. They should have had...
Yeah, I agree with you on there, but I think you have some of these bigger corporations that buy out these smaller ones, and I'm pretty sure that Pepsi bought Quaker Oats years back.
Right.
And then when you have a...
Is that Mondelez now, or who?
But when you have a huge corporation that's mm-hmm. buying up these smaller ones, then it's less of a big deal for them to start changing some of the... So, you know, Aunt Jemima might have been the product line that features Aunt Jemima on the cover might have been huge business for Quaker Oats. But once Pepsi buys up Quaker Oats, and then if someone else, you know, buys up Pepsi, I'm not exactly sure what companies own what companies, but then when the online arrows start getting pointed at them, and we've seen it, I haven't seen things move as quickly as they have these last 2 weeks mm-mm. in my entire life.
Where, me neither.
The changing not only of statues, but the names of, you know, streets and all these other things.
Oh, that's the county name. When are they going to start changing, you know, the Jeff Davis counties? When are they going to start changing Lee counties?
Mm-hmm.
When are they,
you know? And you're seeing these companies change direction fast. And just as long as their company isn't in the crosshairs of the social justice warrior mob, then once they do get in those crosshairs, they're changing things quickly. And that's what we're seeing now with Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben's, and even, like you said, Mrs. Buttersworth.
They're debating her race. I mean, it's Sarah. All right, let's go to the phones. Damon in Mobile is first up. Hey, Damon.
Hey, thanks for taking my call this morning. I've been trying to call in on this topic for months, but it's been a while since we've had to go down this road, but I wanted to touch base with you guys on a couple of things.
Okay.
And when they do things like this, it makes me scratch my head, because just like you, I grew up, no one ever had an issue with it until, you know, now. But there's also, I really believe people really need to be educated, and I wanted to share some things that I've learned recently as a black male.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. I watched a program with Henry Louis Gates, Harvard educated, mm-hmm. does the ancestry thing. And on one of his shows, he asked one of the people on there if he knew what percentage of white people owned slaves. And the guy said, I don't know. And he said, 1%. And he said, actually, it's way less than 1%. So slavery was an institution that was beneficial financially to less than 1% of the white population. Okay?
Okay.
When we talk about slavery and people being angry with whites over slavery, if they were around, if everyone that was a slave owner was around today, it would be less than 1%. So,
right.
First of all.
Very small.
Second, yes, absolutely. So, secondly, the minstrel and the whole thing, slavery was an institution that went on. Poor whites didn't know what went on the plantations. They were private. Well, you know, you couldn't go on a plantation. If someone went on there, they were thought to be trying to steal or what have you. So this institution went on for so long that normal, average, poor whites wondered what life was like for blacks on these plantations. So when slavery ended, it created an entire industry of entertainment, namely minstrel shows, that entertained people. And initially, they were so curious about what was life was like for blacks on these plantations, and it created an entire industry of entertainment, minstrel shows.
So that's what drove the interest in that. That's
yes.
Interesting.
Absolutely, that did, because you know people seem to have this impression that you know every white person had a slave. Slaves were very, very expensive. You know, for $2,000-$3,000, if an average poor white person had that much money, they wouldn't go buy a person with it. They'd buy right. some land and a mule and,
yep.
and plant some and get married and
right.
start their own little farm. So and the other thing I wanted to share is that I learned that a lot of the minstrel shows had black performers. Some of the most popular and the most successful were black performers. A gentleman named Ernest Hogan had the first gold selling record. He was a black minstrel performer from Alabama, and unfortunately I have to use the word, but the song was called All Coons Look Alike to Me, but
oh,
it was the first gold record. He sold thousands of records, but he also he caught a lot of flack from blacks and, you know, the elite whites that said that, you know, set the race back or whatever. But he also was formed the first jazz band with Reese Europe from Mobile, Alabama, who's in the Alabama Music Hall of Fame. They're credited with creating the first jazz band, not a ragtime band, but the first band that played syncopated music, and that's the first jazz band. So
how was that? So based, one member of the band was out of Mobile, you said?
Yes, his name was James Reese Europe. James Reese Europe was a composer and conductor who fought in World War One and received a Medal of Honor but fighting for France because he couldn't fight for the United States. Blacks couldn't, right. They couldn't go serve under our own country. They had to fight for France because,
yes,
you know, blacks were not allowed to. So anyway, he got the French equivalent of a Medal of Honor. He was an officer, first black officer. He's from Mobile, and he's in the Alabama Music Hall of Fame. But he formed this band with Ernest Hogan, who was a black minstrel performer who had the first gold record. And I was reading about another minstrel team called Williams and Walker. They were black minstrel performers. They were the headliners, and they were probably one of the most successful minstrel acts in the country. And so a lot of people need to read up on the whole thing before they just write it off as saying this is this or this is that. You have to do your research. And I also want to end by sharing that I tried to call your show the other day, and I couldn't get in, so I called the Matt Gallagher show. And they were talking about the fact that the Gone with the Wind, they want to take Gone with the Wind, they want to pull it from being able to be viewed.
Right.
Okay?
Yep.
And I shared with him, I learned recently that the author of the book Gone with the Wind, Margaret Mitchell, the president of Morehouse sent her a letter, among other people, trying to build the first black medical school, and she responded and sent some money back. And that started a 10-year correspondence where she sent hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of dollars, building the first black medical school and also other buildings on the campus. When they built the medical school, she paid for the library, the cafeteria. She
Margaret
spent millions
Mitchell?
Of dollars worth of Gone with the Wind money at Morehouse.
Wow.
Secretly.
Wow. So Margaret Mitchell was funding buildings at Morehouse that are still standing now?
Yes. I mean, it went on for years. They estimated it was millions of dollars that she secretly, a messenger would come to her door and give her a letter, and the letter would say, "We need a lab, we need a cafeteria," and she'd write up a check.
Holy cow, what a story. Okay, well, like, David, I've got a list of things I got to research now, but you know where I am. I'm such a homer that I am absolutely obsessed now with James Reese Europe. I've got the page up here, and I'm going to have to start studying up. This is, Mobile stuff. I am fascinated. I was ignorant to this, and I'm going to educate myself on it. Thank you.
I mean, the man had been at the Foxtrot, and if you read up on
which I had to learn,
I had
to, he did the Foxtrot. He's Mobilian, so I'm okay with that because I hated learning that in school. We had to do the Foxtrot, and I messed it up.
Okay.
He
invented it, and he also invented the term gig. When a musician or somebody says they have a gig, he came up with that word.
Wow.
Okay. Okay, it's time for an in-depth dive, Sean, into James Reese Europe. Damon, thank you for that heads up on that, and call me back soon.
All right, thanks, bye.
All right. Now that's what it feels like to have some new areas of your brain opened up. Thank you so much, Damon. Yeah, I'm looking at James Reese Europe here. Mobilian. All right. Time to get some books. If anybody suggests on the text line any good books to read about James Reese Europe, I'm in too as well. All right, 8:51, run to a quick news break, and then we're coming right back. All right, hey, welcome back. Mobile Mornings, 8:55. I'm not the only one that's now off on a learning tangent here, so thank you to Damon who called. And people are asking the name, James Reese Europe. And you pull it up, and I've probably got four pages open here on Google. I'm going to have to read coming up. All right, go to the phones at 343-0106. We got to make it snappy here. Just got a little bit of time before the news cuts us off. And my buddy Buck in Hurley is up first. Hey, Buck.
Hey, good morning, Sean.
Morning.
Hey, I'm gonna stir it up before you get off air.
Go ahead.
But I'll be available. So I refuse to believe that all of Black America's problems is white people, and because we're all racist, because we're not. Life is very tough. I wake up every day at 3:30 in the morning. I'm at the barn by 4:15. I work a full-time job. I come home and I deal with the farm after work. If you want to be successful, or you can be, regardless of your race, your color, your disability, there's things out there for you. And you got to dig deep and you got to want it. You just can't point the fingers at everybody else and blame all your problems on other people. I haven't heard anything about self-responsibility yet.
No, I think that goes for a lot of people. I mean, you look at today's society, I mean, you know, you can pick many skin colors or genders or whatever and say, you know, did you put in the day that Buck put in yesterday? It's a fair question.
Yeah, if you want it, you got to dig deep and get it. Life is very hard, regardless of your color, your race, your age, your disability, whatever it may be. Life is hard, and you got to really want to be successful. You can be a victim if you want to be.
Yeah, that's true. Well said. Well said. Buck, I appreciate it, man. We got to go up against the end of the hour, but we'll be doing it again today at noon for Midday Mobile. We're going to be atop the USS Alabama on the fantail there, doing the show from noon to 1. And then at 1 o'clock, Scuttlebutt Radio Network, a show for veterans, by veterans. My buddy Tom Claxton, Cal Walters, and the crew will be taking over from 1 to 2. But we will be at the USS Alabama, which is like my favorite place to do a radio show. So it's going to be a lot of fun doing that today. So tune in. And remember, check out podcasts of this show or the 44-some-odd hours a week of live local programming that comes from our studios here, organic, homegrown radio. You check those podcasts out by going to fmtalk1065.com, clicking the link for podcast, or better yet, subscribe to get them at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, where you can stream the station. They've got our podcast, Spotify. Any podcast platform out there should have a way to subscribe for FM Talk 106.5. If it doesn't, let us know. I think we've got them all. All right. Mike Gallagher on the way next.